But I have a chart of diamond mining stocks over the last 2.5 years, and they were down 17% in 2017, 29% in 2018, and they're already down 14% this year. So I mean, they've really been hit hard, and I think it's overdone.
This episode of Mining Stock Education is brought to you by U.S. Gold Corp. U.S. Gold Corp. is a U.S.-focused gold exploration and development company advancing high potential projects in Wyoming and Nevada. U.S. Gold Corp. has consolidated a district on Nevada's productive Cortez Trend and is advancing the Copper King project towards production in Wyoming. Led by a team of prolific company builders and renowned explorers, including Dave Mathewson, who's directly responsible for several major Nevada gold discoveries, U.S. Gold Corp. is well-financed and has an extremely tight share structure with less than 20 million shares outstanding, and it trades on a major stock exchange, the NASDAQ, under the ticker USAU. To learn more, go to usgoldcorp.gold. That's usgoldcorp.gold. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mining Stock Education, and I'm Bill Powers, your host. Thanks for tuning in. If you want to engage the show, you can always reach me at bill@miningstockeducation.com. Well, we know that diamonds are a woman's best friend, but today we're going to learn whether diamonds can also be the resource investor's friend. Joining me today is Paul Zimnisky. He's well known for his work as an independent analyst and consultant in the diamond and mining industry. He's also a chartered financial analyst, and he's worked in the capital markets industry for over 10 years. He's also a contributor to many industry-leading trade journals and websites, and he's a regular speaker on diamonds at numerous conferences around the world. And he also launched recently his own podcast, which I encourage you to check out, and that's Paul Zimnisky Diamond Analytics. So, Paul, thanks for coming on Mining Stock Education.
Thanks so much for having me, Bill.
All right, let's jump right into it. So what is your background, and how did you come to focus on diamonds?
So my background is as a buy-side equity analyst. I started my career working for a family office in New York. I worked on their natural resource portfolio. And regarding diamonds, I guess I've just always been intrigued by the industry. It has a very rich history, and it's kind of perceived as mysterious, which I think makes it interesting. And then, you know, if you look from an investment standpoint, it's a relatively underfollowed industry for reasonable reasons. But I think when you have a situation like that, it always creates an opportunity that, you know, perhaps does not exist with a space that's more closely followed, like gold or copper. So I always kind of, you know, I kind of like niche spaces for that reason.
When we look at diamonds, how are the price of diamonds determined? And you mentioned gold and copper. How is it different than how gold and copper, the price per ounce or the price per pound, is determined?
So it's end consumer demand is what's ultimately going to drive the prices, you know, and of course supply. However, historically, De Beers had strategically managed global supply, which would allow it to support prices. So a lot of people think diamond prices are artificially driven. But De Beers liquidated their stockpile between 2000 and 2004, and diamond prices made an all-time high in 2011, almost a decade after the De Beers monopoly was dismantled. So I think, you know, one of the biggest effects of the De Beers stockpile was lower volatility in prices, but not necessarily higher prices. I think that the biggest impact that De Beers had on diamond prices was the demand that it drove through one of the most successful marketing campaigns of all time. All of that said, between De Beers and the Russians, they currently produce, you know, 2/3 of global diamond supply, and they have a contract sales mechanism. So in that sense, they're managing prices, but when they set their prices, they take into account the tender market, and they pay, you know, close attention to supply demand fundamentals. But when conditions do get really bad, they will hold supply from market. And we last saw this in 2015 when the Chinese economy slowed and that hurt global diamond demand. But the leaders, you look at De Beers and the Russians, and, you know, Rio Tinto and Dominion Diamond would be in that category as well. They don't necessarily protect prices for the independents, as you think would be the case. And I think this is substantiated by the fact that quite a few of the independent diamond miners are under considerable stress at the moment because diamond prices have been relatively weak over the last 5 years.
So as I walk through Home Depot and I'm going through the tool section, I can see that there's some saw blades that are diamond tipped. So obviously there's industrial demand there. What's the breakdown between industrial demand and jewelry demand in the diamond market?
Yeah, so when we look at diamond mining as an industry, almost all of the demand for that product is driven by the jewelry industry. When you look from a volume standpoint, I would say most of diamonds that are produced when you look naturally and synthetically are industrial grade quality diamonds. But I'll try to give you some context here. So natural diamond production will say be approximately 150 million carats this year, but there'll be 12 billion carats of synthetic diamonds produced for industrial application. So to answer the question, the synthetic basically catered to almost all of the industrial demand, I'd say probably 99%. And that's produced in factories in China. And then from a natural diamond mining standpoint, almost all of the demand for that product is driven by the higher value, higher quality stones that make the economics work for a diamond mine. I would just look at the diamonds that are sold for industrial purposes from a diamond mine. It's strictly a byproduct. There's no mines that are economic, lower quality industrial production. It's almost all driven by the jewelry market.
Are the synthetic, the lab made diamonds, are they as strong as the ones that we mine out of the earth?
Yeah. So it's chemically diamond. So it's the same from that standpoint. I think when you look at diamond, based on the quality and the, of the diamond, it's going to determine, the strength of the diamond, whether it's, worn as jewelry or used for industrial purposes. But the diamonds that are synthetically made are still chemically diamond.
On the jewelry front, do they look the same? Would the average person be able to tell the difference?
Yeah, it looks with the naked eye, you cannot distinguish. You need special equipment to distinguish between the two. But I think the important takeaway is that you can differentiate between a natural and a synthetic diamond with certainty, but you do need special equipment, which is becoming more widely available.
In the gold space, people have speculated that one thing that would destroy gold mining would be if somehow we're able to chemically create gold in a lab. Therefore, we have this abundance of supply. The price would go down. We wouldn't need gold mining anymore. On the synthetic front with diamonds, could something like that occur?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting you bring up gold. So you actually can synthetically produce gold. We need a particle collider and a lot of energy, so it's nowhere near economic. So I don't think the gold miners have to worry about that anytime soon. However, we're definitely starting to see the proliferation of lab-created diamonds. The cost to produce them has come down substantially. It still represents, I'd say, less than 5% of the market, but I think its potential, for it to grow significantly. And I think the question becomes, is it going to cannibalize the natural diamonds, or is it more going to be perceived by consumers as a fashion jewelry product that's not going to necessarily directly compete with a natural diamond, which would be considered fine jewelry. So we're kind of in this kind of transition phase where the product is becoming available to consumers. The price is a little bit lower, but it's not low enough where it would be put in the fashion jewelry category. So it's kind of unclear how it's going to play out right now, but I think it's going to ultimately come down to how the product is marketed, and not just how the lab-created diamond is marketed, but how the natural diamond industry continues to market their product. And I think going forward, I think the price of lab-created diamonds will continue to come down substantially. And I think that differentiation in price is going to differentiate the lab-created diamond into a fashion jewelry product. So I think it's going to have it's going to compete less with natural diamonds as the price gets really, really low.
So is it trading? Do you buy it at a 50% discount to an actual diamond? What percentage on average do you see the lab created diamonds being sold for?
Yeah, so it's moving very quickly. I would say 5 years ago, lab created diamonds were maybe 10% cheaper than an equivalent natural. Now it's, up to 60-70% cheaper.
Well, that's significant.
At a wholesale level, they're like 85% cheaper. So it's moving very, very rapidly. There's a lot of money being invested and lab-created diamond, production technology, and it's resulting in higher yields and better output at cheaper prices. So, I think that trend will continue, and I think that's ultimately what's going to differentiate the two products is the price. And then in the background, you kind of have all the industry participants are understanding the implication of this, and I think they're doing everything they can to try to start differentiating the product, using marketing and making sure, this detection technology that you could use to distinguish between the two is readily available and affordable, so, every industry participant can have it. There's certainly concern that it's going to take demand away from the natural industry, and I think that's why you see weakness in some of these independent producers at the moment. I would say the sentiment has gotten so low; it's almost like there's an implication that these companies aren't going to make it. But I think it's way overdone. I think if you couldn't distinguish between between a natural diamond and a lab created diamond, then I think all bets would be off. But I think as long as we can continue to distinguish between the two, and we have the detection technology is readily available, and the natural industry continues to successfully market itself as a fine jewelry product and as a different product from a lower priced lab created diamond, I think the industry is going to be okay, and it has a very long resilient history, so I don't think I would bet against the natural diamond industry.
We'll be right back after this word from our sponsor. Orin Resources is a junior exploration company with the appetite of a major, focused on finding the next globally significant discovery to create enormous potential upside for shareholders. It's one of the most aggressive exploration companies pursuing high-grade, scalable gold and copper deposits, and has a premier 7-project portfolio, including its 2 flagships, Committee Bay in the Arctic and Sombrero in Peru. With Orin's unparalleled technical team and highly experienced management with a history of success in advancing and monetizing exploration assets, Orin has been called one of the best in the junior exploration sector. Orin trades on the TSX and NYSE under the ticker AUG. To learn more, go to orinresources.com. That's AURYN resources.com.
Have you done any analog comparisons? Like, for example, a woman with a lot of money wants a mink coat, and there's the market for the artificial man-made mink coat, and then there's the actual mink fur. Do markets like that, do they kind of give us an indication of where this synthetic diamond market might go?
Yeah, I think you can actually just use another kind of gemstone as a better maybe analog. You look at, ruby, emerald, and sapphires, and they've been, available in synthetic form for decades now. And you can walk into your local jeweler and probably buy a flawless, 1-carat emerald for, $50. So they're substantially cheaper, and it's a completely different market than if you kind of went into that same store and wanted to buy a natural emerald. So I think it's like anything else. I think, people still perceive diamonds as natural diamonds. So when this new product comes to market, that's, half the price. People kind of still think they're buying a diamond, but it's a different product because it doesn't have that inherent rarity. And I think that's important when you're talking about a luxury product. I think if we're talking about a diamond used for industrial purposes, I think the lowest price alternative that performs the same is probably the one you're going to go with. But when we're talking about luxury and the emotion attached to purchasing a luxury item, I think the inherent rarity and the inherent value of a natural diamond because of the inherent rarity kind of sets it apart. And I think that's an important component of a luxury product.
I want to go in a little bit more into investing in diamond mining companies. But before we do that, you mentioned in your introduction that the price of diamonds rose steeply in 2011. What was the cause of that?
So that was coming out of the global financial crisis. Obviously, there was a huge credit crunch throughout almost every industry. And that resulted in a pairing of diamond production. So supply was coming off. And right around that same time, there was this surge in new demand coming out of China as consumers started purchasing diamond engagement rings for the first time. So you got this, huge demand rush out of mostly China, but also India. At the same time, we were seeing a decrease in global supply. And actually, diamonds were one of the fastest commodities to recover post-global financial crisis because of this. But that spurred exploration, and it spurred new mine development. And I think that's kind of what led to the price weakness now. We've actually had too much supply come online in the last 5 years. And I think the industry is, you know, kind of working through that at the moment. But I think the opposite effect is going to happen now, where prices have gotten low enough where the economics really don't make sense to explore as aggressively and develop, you know, new mines as we saw 5 years ago. So looking 5 or 10 years into the future, supply is going to come off quite substantially. And given that it takes usually a minimum of 5 to 10 years to put a new mine into production, you can get a pretty good idea of what that supply is going to look like in a, you know, 5 to 10 year window into the future.
Do you have to look at the overall economy when you're analyzing the future demand for diamonds? Because if it's most of the demand is coming from jewelry, then it's more of a luxury, not absolutely needed commodity. So when you do your analyzing of what the demand will be, I assume you look at the macroeconomic situation as well.
Yeah, that's right. It's when you kind of run the numbers and do the analysis, diamond demand historically is correlated very high with global GDP. So I think you can kind of use that as a basis. It gets a little bit more complex when you look at the emerging markets. So to kind of quantify this, the U.S. represents 50% of global diamond jewelry demand. So the U.S. is still by far the largest market. China is approaching 20%. India is approaching 10%. But at the current growth rates, it looks as if China and India will probably, outtake the U.S. as the largest market, probably over the next decade and a half. So I think that dynamic is kind of changing quite rapidly. And if we do see, say, a slowdown or a normalization in the U.S., I think, you know, you look at, India and China, and I think that could potentially be, the significant growth driver the industry needs going forward.
When you look at the opportunity in investing in the actual companies themselves, you mentioned De Beers and there's other ones. What are some things you are looking for in a diamond mining company right now that would make that an attractive investment to you?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's only a handful of publicly traded diamond miners that are standalones. There's a handful in Canada. What I would say is that most of the newer producers still have debt that they took out to build, you know, the mines. There were three new mines that commenced production in 2017. Two were in Canada. The Gahcho Kué mine in the Northwest Territories, it's a 51-49 joint venture between De Beers and Mountain Province Diamonds, which is a publicly traded company. And then you have the Renard mine in Quebec, which is wholly owned by Stornoway Diamond, which is also publicly traded. So they both took on debt to bring on new mines that commenced production in 2017. Again, we've had, we've had relatively flat to moderately declining diamond prices for the last 5 or 6 years. And you have companies that kind of have debt on the balance sheet. I think it's creating some concern. Then you have institutional investors that are concerned about the potential impact of lab-created diamonds, potential economic slowing in a couple of years, ending, the current economic cycle. I think that's a concern. So I think kind of when you look at, you kind of look at all these pieces of the puzzle, I think it's a legitimate for there to be some concern, but I think it's gotten a little bit overdone. I recently wrote an article. It's available on my website. I put it out on April 5th. But I have a chart of diamond mining stocks over the last 2.5 years. And if you kind of take a basket of these standalone diamond miners and kind of weight them by market cap, they were down 17% in 2017, 29% in 2018. And they're already down 14%, this year. So I mean, they've really been hit hard, I think it's overdone. So I think you definitely want to take into account, companies that are, kind of de-risk their mining operations and have a manageable debt load. But again, you're dealing with mining, which is inherently a risky business. There's a lot of, operationally, there's a lot of things that can go wrong. And then, when you have a commodity price that really hasn't been going in your favor, it can become complicated and difficult. But I think more than enough of that risk has been factored into to most of these names at this point. And I think the supply situation that we talked about before is going to be supportive of prices. And I think if we have, even continued moderate demand growth, I think, the economics of, some of these companies looks pretty good.
What about diamond exploration companies? At PDAC, I met with a lot of CEOs and did some one-on-one meetings, and I had my first one-on-one meeting with a CEO of a diamond exploration company. I know that his stock chart, of course, there's many things that can drive an exploration company's stock chart, but his stock chart was down dramatically, as you're mentioning, over the last 6 months. When you're looking at a potential speculation in an early stage exploration diamond company, what are you looking for, and what are some risks to avoid?
Yeah, I think it's just like, any other mining company. I think, management is key. The asset is key. Experience is key. Being, funded and have availability for additional funding if it's needed. What I would say is, diamonds are a little bit different from, say, gold or copper exploration. The starting point is very vast, which makes exploration challenging, whereas most metals are found in volcanic or sedimentary rock formations. Kimberlite can intrude pretty much any kind of rock formation. So it's really hard to narrow down deposits. In addition, kimberlite pipes where diamonds are found, they're relatively small. Once you actually do find a kimberlite, very few actually have diamonds. They're diamondiferous. And then even fewer are economic. So, there's certainly a relatively high risk reward here. Once you actually do kind of make a discovery, that the sampling process is quite rigorous and expensive. Given that diamonds lack fungibility, there's say 10,000 different categories. You need to take a large enough sample to try to predict what the actual product mix looks like, meaning, how many large diamonds are there, how many diamonds that are of good color and quality. So it becomes, quite nuanced from that standpoint. And I think that's kind of why, some investors have shied away, because I think there's an additional layer of complexity with diamonds that you maybe don't have with gold or copper in that regard.
As you're listening to us talk about diamonds, there's an opportunity here, as Paul said, that if this sector could be potentially oversold right now. And for those that are willing to put in the man hours of study and analyzing and researching opportunities, you could be rewarded nicely if the thesis is right and we see diamond prices rise and some of these miners could have a nice rebound. Paul, as we conclude, could you share your contact information and how people can follow you?
Sure. I have information on my website. It's paulzaniski.com. I'm pretty active at Twitter. It's at Paul Zaniski. And if anybody wants to reach out with any questions, I do have my contact information on my website.
And you recently launched your own podcast. Can you give us any teasers for some upcoming episodes and what listeners might expect?
Sure. I guess if you want maybe a more nuanced discussion of what we had today, you could give that a listen. I only have one up so far, but it's available on iTunes if you search Paul Zaniski Diamond Analytics Podcast, and there's more episodes in the works.
Well, thanks, Paul. I appreciate you joining me today to discuss diamonds. Have a great day.
Thanks, Bill.
This episode of Mining Stock Education is brought to you by Blue Sky Uranium Corporation. Blue Sky Uranium has first mover advantage in Argentina in the world's newest uranium and vanadium district. With an existing near-surface deposit that is open for expansion, Blue Sky Uranium also controls a massive district-scale land package with mineralization along a 145-kilometer-long trend. Blue Sky Uranium possesses tremendous exploration upside and is an excellent leverage play on rising uranium and vanadium prices. The company is run by a best class management and technical team with proven exploration and development success in Argentina. Blue Sky Uranium trades under the ticker BSK on the Toronto Venture Exchange and as BKUCF on the OTC. For more information and to stay on top of the latest news, go to blueskyuranium.com. That's blueskyuranium.com. Thank you for listening to this Mining Stock Education podcast. Please subscribe and share with like-minded investors. Visit us on the web at miningstockeducation.com for more resources on precious metals and natural resource investing. At our website, you can also sign up for our free newsletter for interview transcripts, stock picks, and more.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be considered personal legal or investment advice or a recommendation to buy or sell securities or any other product. We make every effort to be accurate, but the information presented is not to be considered infallible. It may contain errors, and we offer no inferred or explicit warranty. If personal advice is needed, consult a qualified legal, tax, or investment professional. Do not base any investment decision on the information contained on miningstockeducation.com, our podcasts, or videos. Make sure you always conduct your own thorough due diligence before investing. Realize that we may hold equity positions in or be compensated by some of the companies we feature and therefore are biased and hold an obvious conflict of interest. For our full disclaimer, please visit our website.